Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. One of the things that came up during a reading last week, one of the Dhamma readings that we have most days, was an interesting point about the concept of Nirodha, cessation. This is the third of the Four Noble Truths, the truth of Nirodha, Dukkha Nirodha, the cessation, usually translated as the cessation of suffering. But what was also presented by Ajahn Pasno was like a note from a very worthy little book on the subject of dependent origination called Dependent Origination and where the author talks about this word and particularly the difficulty of translating it into English, because in the cycle of dependent origination, which so I was talking about somewhat last week, we talk about the two attributes of it, or the two cycles, the anuloma and the patiloma, the arising side and the ceasing side. And so the arising side is the one that you know, those of us who've looked at a bit of Buddhist teachings and studied this a little bit will have seen this, you know, the 12 links of causation. Both northern and southern traditions have many, many instances where these are talked about. So if we're familiar mostly with the arising side, with ignorance as condition, formations come to be with formations as condition, consciousness comes to be, etc., through nama-rupa, mind and body, six senses, contact, feeling, craving, clinging, becoming, birth, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair, and so on. And then the cessation side is when we do the chant of this, we chant both of these parts together. Firstly, the arising, the avicca pachaya sankara, sankara pachaya vijnanam, and so on. And then when we get to the soka parideva dukkha dominas upayasa, then there's a pause. It's like a turning point. And then we recite the words avicaya toeva asesa viraga nirodha. Avicaya toeva, with the complete cessation of avicca, then there is the cessation of formations, sankhara, karmic formations or volitional formations. Formations is many different ways the word gets translated. When ignorance ceases, then these other all the other elements of the 12-fold chain cease. Now, what was pointed out in that little note on the word Nirodha is that the it's almost like starting out with the, it seems to read in the way it's most often presented, that you've already started out with sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair and so on, and that as ignorance ceases, then that causes the formations to cease. With the formations ceasing, then the vijnana, consciousness and so forth up the chain. But what he points out is, rather than this kind of cascade effect that is the way it comes across in English most often, is a different picture, and it's a picture of that Nirodha can also mean like the non-arising of, or the non-appearance of, when this does not happen, so that it can in a way it's presented by sort of going through each of the 12 links, but in a way you could also say when there is no ignorance, when there is no avijja, then the story is, the problem's over, full stop. You could stop right there. But of course, the Buddhist teachings being extremely thorough and very sort of punctilious and repetitive, and of course we go through all of the 12 links. But it's like saying, you know, if you don't strike a match, then you don't light the candle. If you haven't got the candle lit, then the candle doesn't fall over. If the candle doesn't fall over, it doesn't light the curtain. If the curtain doesn't catch fire, then it doesn't set the living room on fire. If the living room doesn't sit on fire, then you don't set the house on fire. If you don't set the house on fire, then you don't lose all the money in your savings because you didn't have the place insured. It just says nobody lit a match. Full stop. Like the burning house does not have to arise. You don't have to mention it. It's that we don't get that far because the fire is not ignited in the first place. So this is an important aspect of the whole cycle of dependent origination, because it's like saying, well, if you stopped ignorance, how come you're still having to deal with becoming and craving and clinging and all of that kind of, that sticky stuff down at that end of the spectrum? And the fact is that if we look a little more deeply into that, the meaning of that word, it's the fact is that we don't have to deal with that. If there is sufficient mindfulness, awareness established at the very beginning of things, then if ignorance is not allowed to arise, then the trouble doesn't begin, the fire doesn't start. It's a non-problem. So this is a lot to do with the aim of the practice, what we are, the effort of meditation, the effort of ethical training, and the elements of the path, studying the teachings, listening to Dhamma talks, keeping the sila, practicing meditation, training the mind in insight and concentration, and developing the powers of investigation and so forth. These are all the path. These are, and the point of the practice is not to develop the path. The point of the practice is to arrive at the goal. All of us in this monastery live in little kutis, in cabins off in the forest, and so that between the places where we live, we have that little path or big path. Some of us walk by the main road, or some of us have just little trails. But the point of the trails is not to be on the trail. The point of the trail is to get from the house, you know, the Dhamma hall here, back to my kuti, or get from my kuti to the center of the forest, or get from my kuti down to here. It's extremely handy to have a path, clear and open, well worn, with all the brush cut back and the step, you know, nice firm steps cut in, You don't have to bash your way through the bushes every time. Find a way through the undergrowth and clambering through the creeks and through the poison oak. And every time we want to get from A to B, it's great having a clear, open path. But the point of the path is not the path. The point of the path is to get to B at the end of it. So that this is important to bear in mind, is that all of these different elements of techniques and training and practice, the generosity, virtue, meditation, even the development of wisdom, investigation, and these more subtle elements of the practice, even the development of insight, meditation, the doingness of all of those things, these are method. These are the path, they're not the goal. So just having that clear in one's mind is very helpful. And so what this is talking about, this establishment of what we use the path to do, is to cultivate the basis of clarity and awareness, attunement of heart to Dhamma, so that we are aware, constantly aware of the truth of the way things are, the true reality of things. So in a way, it's like establishing the heart in vijja rather than avijja, in knowing rather than not knowing. So this is the aim of it, and that in a way, this is not even though we talk about it as a practice. You can say, the practice of knowing, but it really, it's as long as there's an element of me doing something, there's a me practicing something, me meditating, me trying to develop this, me working to get beyond that, then this is all still the element of the path. And that to constantly be on the path is like walking backwards and forwards between here and the kuti all the time, and actually never stopping at either of the buildings. It's really tiring and exhausting and pretty cold and damp sometimes as well. So, and basically pointless. You think, well, I'm on the path. I'm really working at the, I'm developing the path here. It's like, well, right, but why not enjoy the goal? Why not just stop in your kuti for a while? Why not just, when you get to your destination, when you get down to the end of the path, when you arrive at the Dhamma hall here, or you arrive at the house, it's like, arrived. Notice how that feels. Arrival, this is good. So that as we do, put all this effort into developing the meditation, the practice, then to also enjoy where we arrive, to enjoy the Dhamma, to actually appreciate that. What is the mind like when there is no ignorance? When in a way the path has been followed to its goal, when we have sustained, there's a sustaining of awareness, mindfulness, and the heart is awake, there's no grasping. Do we recognize that? Do we see that? Do we know that? Or do we just are we so sort of compulsively on the path that we think, oh, well, I can't just stop, I better go back. Can't just stop here, I've got to go places. It's ridiculous when we talk about it that way, but it's so easy to become a compulsive meditator that we feel that we've always got to be doing something. And so that we, in a way, putting forth all this effort, cultivating this fruit, but never actually tasting it. And so that what this is talking about is that when we have practiced well, in those moments when there is clear awareness, to let the heart be clearly conscious of that. What is that experience of arrival? What is that experience of the Dhamma? How does it feel? The heart free from clinging, the heart free from ignorance, and there's moments of clear awareness. What is that? Well, the characteristics of the Dhamma that we recite in the chanting, apparent here and now, timeless, encouraging investigation, leading inwards. These are all very simple, straightforward qualities that are described. Or particularly as in one of Ajahn Chah's talks that I was looking at in the last week, was his description of the Buddha and the Dhamma. The Buddha is the one who knows, that arises from the heart, established in virtue, concentration and wisdom. And the Dhamma is the qualities of purity, radiance and peacefulness that are realized by the one who knows. When the heart is established in virtue, concentration and wisdom, what is known is by that heart is purity, radiance, peacefulness. Another translation of the word Nirodha is is a negative, like no or without, and rud is to check or to limit, to hold. So it's that which is unheld, or that which is limitless, that which is unchecked, unbounded. So that this is pointing to a quality of heart which is extremely simple, that which is utterly at ease, pure, radiant, peaceful, unlimited, limitless. Or in other teachings, the Buddha described this as the mind which is invisible, limitless, radiant in all directions. Anidasanam anantang sabato pavang. So to be working with that in the terms of our practice, to train the heart to realize the Dhamma, to notice that, and to learn how to rest in the knowing of that reality. And then as the and to see that this is the point of all of the doingness, the doingness of me practicing meditation, me doing something, the point of it is this goal is for the heart to know the Dhamma, the true reality of things. To know its own nature. It's like often, again, in these teachings of Ajahn Chah that we've been looking at, he says over and over again, mind is Dhamma. This is the ultimate reality of things. The ultimate reality of your own mind is Dhamma. It's not somewhere else. It's not some kind of ephemeral essence that's sort of floating off in the ether, or that it's somehow apart from us, or separate from us, or different from us. But the very fabric, the very substance, the nature of this very mind, the mind which is knowing this moment, the sound of this voice, the feelings of heat or cold, the feelings of pleasure or displeasure, the moods, the qualities of alertness or dullness or comfort or discomfort. This mind, this is Dhamma, this is the true nature of things. So then we can easily grasp that, you know, and this is a big problem in the spiritual world, of saying, well, my true nature is a pure ultimate reality, and therefore I can do what I like, or, you know, I am pure absolute ultimate reality, and therefore taking that idea and having faith in that principle, then becoming completely swamped with the products of ignorance that are obscuring that. It's rather like saying, I've got a refrigerator full of food, or I've got piles of money in the bank, but you don't necessarily draw on it. Or you've got this refrigerator full of food, you say, yeah, I've got all the food in the world, I've got this huge refrigerator full of food, But you can still starve to death with a refrigerator full of food, you know, fully in your possession. It's your fridge and it's your food, but if you don't actually open the door and get it out and eat it, then we're going to starve. So similarly, even though this quality of the Dhamma is truly, absolutely the fundamental nature of what the universe is, mental and physical, that unless we apply the appropriate means to open the door and to prepare the meal, then we will starve. So that means that just having the idea of it, or just having a concept of the fact of it, is not enough. And this is why we cultivate all these practices. This is why we develop meditation, we develop restraint, we develop simplicity of living and kindness, honesty, gentleness and so forth. These are all the means whereby we go to the door, we recognize the handle, we pull the handle, we open the door, we choose the food, we take it out, we chop it up and mix it up and prepare it, cook it, consume it, and then we can be nourished. Just the idea that it's there is really insufficient. So it's important to, in a way, have a conceptual map like this. At least I find for myself that it's certainly important to have a strong sense of application and vigor and the need to work on training the heart, and that's certainly to be emphasized and is a powerful theme of our practice and our way, but to just to have that sense of being cautious about obsessiveness, the feeling of the kind of subtle intrusion of the becoming urge, the bhava tanha, the desire to become, that's crept in, of whereby if I'm not practicing, if I'm not doing something, if I'm not working on something, getting rid of something, concentrating on something, developing insight into something, letting go of something, then the universe is out of order. I've got to be doing something, I've got to be practicing, I should be. This is the outflow of becoming. It sneaks in. This is sort of one of the meditator's diseases. Reasonable becoming, legal becoming, trying to become peaceful. Become wise, become kind. It's better than becoming selfish and cruel and jealous and restless. Well, for sure, but it's a disease also, because it's exactly the same as like you come down the path and you get to the house and you feel like, well, I'm not on the path anymore. I better get on the path again, and then you set off around the loop trail, because then you're on the path and you're going somewhere. It's as absurd as that in many ways. So a lot of this is to do with realizing the Dhamma. So we practice as a practicing the Dhamma, realizing the Dhamma. And then the final piece that Ajahn Chah would also try to emphasize is that of being Dhamma. So oftentimes with the meditation, we work hard at studying Dhamma, practicing Dhamma, realizing Dhamma, we get to that point of insight. But then we go back to the practicing, the doingness, the me getting somewhere. And we miss the being Dhamma. And this is where we find the real quality of rest. Rest for the heart, which is not a rest of just sort of zoning out. And like the couch potato or zafu potato, resting. like sitting on our zafu and turning into a zombie. It's not that kind of rest. It's a totally energetic rest, but it's the rest of realizing there's nobody here and there's nothing to do. The Dhamma is perfect and complete, exactly as it is. The nature of the heart, the nature of mind and body and the world is just as it is. And that in that realization is the place of pure rest and ease for us. Now these qualities of the asavas, or the different ways that you know, we can maybe establish that realization and rest in that for some time, but then that these asavas, these little clouds of ignorance, just drift in, don't they? Little kind of blurrinesses, hazinesses of the mind, or large hazinesses, or complete blacknesses. Come rolling in, don't they? That they, we suddenly, it's all clear and fine and dandy one moment, next thing we know we're just obsessing about something that happened 10 years ago, or planning something in 3 years' time, or worrying about that ache in our ankle. It's become that which has filled the universe. So, you know, so much of our effort, our work, is to notice those qualities of cloudiness, how that arises, and that the effort of the practice is seeing those different qualities of the different asavas, the different outflows, just the dulling of the mind itself, avijasava, the lack, the losing of mindfulness. The kind of the gentle dulling of the moment, the asava of sense desire, the mind seeking the pleasant, the sweet, the beautiful, the delicious. About the mind taking hold of an opinion, an idea, a belief, like taking the idea of, you know, all beings have Buddha nature. I am the Dhamma. Everything is Dhamma. Inside is Dhamma. Outside is Dhamma. Everything is Dhamma. Ajahn Chah said that. So everything in me, everything outside me, well, everything that I am is Dhamma. Hey, great. That means I'm fine. Hey, great. This, and then we don't realize this is actually our defilements talking at that moment, rather than wisdom. Hey, great, that means I can goof off. And that grabbing that opinion, even though it sounds like that it's the voice of wisdom, it's just the voice of wisdom being imitated. Mara doing copying the voice of wisdom. And we found ourselves drifting into believing that opinion, riding on that opinion, riding on that belief, that hope, that plan. There's 1,000 different ways that these different blurry, clouded, deluded states drift in, take over. So this is why we practice, this is why we cultivate, this is why we put forth effort, is to learn to recognize that kind of drift coming in. That's when the application of the practice is most crucial, is necessary. Like when we do need to go somewhere, yeah, get on the path, go. When we've arrived at our destination, then let ourselves be at ease there. In understanding that quality of ease, it's really essential for us to not mistake comfort or things going the way we choose for that, you know, ease on an ultimate level. One of the teachings that Ajahn Chah stresses over and over again in his Dhamma talks is the using the quality of reflection and reflecting upon the downside of happiness, the downside of things going well according to our wishes. Now you must, just saying those words, it might easily seem like it's a really kind of negative outlook on life, a sort of sourpuss view. It's all miserable, it's all horrible. Yeah, well, you know, it might be nice today, but well, it's be terrible soon. You know, end of the world is nigh, end of mentality. But it's not that at all. It's just as there's the upside, the asada, there's to all experience. There's the adinava, there's the downside. There's the gratification, and then there's the danger. So what this means is that is like for example, when we are friendly with someone, when things are going well, and we're married to someone, or we have someone as a partner, then and everything is going fine, then we don't necessarily think about how all those years of it being good are at the same time as them being good and delicious and fine and fine and harmonious and exactly as we would choose. We don't notice how at that moment we're being set up for grief and pain, for when it's all over, when the couple has split and there's kind of pain and acrimony and loss. And also, you know, it's you don't think how like particularly in a very say painful split of a couple. I think we've all been involved in this when people split up, you know, who decides which friend goes with which half of the couple? And what do mutual friends do? It gets to be a really complicated dance, doesn't it? It's like, you know, not even people who are married, people who are sort of dear friends with each other, and then that, you know, A's not talking to B and B's not talking to C, and then anything that if you talk to A, then B is offended because you're talking to her. I don't know what you're doing talking to her, and then you talk to B and they can't, B can't believe that you're still tolerating the presence of A. But for years and years, A and B were cheerfully having and chugging along together and really enjoying each other's company and having a grand old time. But when that's happening, do we notice? Do we see that goodness is a cause for grief? You know, just like this it can be, it doesn't have to be a relationship, anything. Just the health of the body. You know, do we notice that this is a fragile state, or are we just going to wait until some major piece of it stops working before we start feeling grief for the loss of that, or this monastery when, you know, if everything, you know, everything is in a very much a kind of onward and upward phase here. You know, that now we've been here for 5 years, and you know, the place is developing very finely. The community is steadily growing. People are really good-hearted and committed, and extremely honest and strict with the discipline, and harmonious in many, many ways. And physically, we've done a lot of good construction, and people admire the different things that we've done, and it's all fine and dandy. And so then, if we attach to this and think that this is absolutely good, then we take refuge in, you know, this particular group of people or this particular institution or this particular sort of physical structure. Then when a fire sweeps through and destroys it all, or when the community cracks up, I mean, and for some kind of crisis happens, if I run off with a 16-year-old, or Ajahn Pasno decides to have a sex change, He didn't tell you about that. We didn't put that in the newsletter. Larry runs off with all the money. Debbie becomes a born-again Christian. Decides she's going to convert us all or destroy the place in the attempt. Then suddenly hit by this terrible sense of loss and grief. Oh, it's all gone. It was so good, and now it's gone. And as the Buddha said, if you have 100 dear ones, you have 100 pains. You have 90 dear ones, 90 pains. 80, 70, 60, 50, 40, 30, 20, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. It's the short version of the sutta. If you have one dear one, you have one pain. If you have no dear ones, you have no pains. The arahants are painless because they have no dear ones, which again one can interpret as being sort of cold-hearted or like but it's, in a way it's like the physics of the heart. In if the more that the heart as much as the heart invests in some configuration of the four elements, the five khandhas, as being a particular way, then to that degree it will suffer because they change. It can't hold together. So that dearness, piya, is the Pali word, piya, that dearness, that holding of it. Ajahn Chah would so often point to, look at that investment of the heart, look at that holding. Look at that which likes happy, chooses happiness. He used the example of a snake. Like if you grab hold of the head of a snake, it's painful immediately. It bites you straight away in this pain. But if you take hold of the tail, it doesn't take more than a couple of seconds for it to whip around and bite you. He says, suffering is like the head of the snake and happiness is like the tail. If you pick up either end, you get it. The correct way to pick up a snake is to take a long stick and then you carefully place the stick just behind the head, press gently down, and then take a firm grip behind where the stick is, not towards the tooth end, towards the tail end. You take firm grip and pick up the snake behind the stick, which is, in a way, it's indicative of the way we need to practice. It's like we tend to choose the austere end of things. We tend to choose the simplicity and renunciation. We choose the sort of the toothy end, but which is deliberately choosing the limitation of the precepts, the limitation of simplicity of living. But we pick it up. We pick up the snake, having carefully immobilized it with the stick of mindfulness. We pick it up at that end. So then its tail can thrash around, but the tail's not dangerous. If we just grab the tail of happiness, then pretty soon it bites us. So this is something that it really takes a lot of effort to stay with and to really track. Like one incident we've often talked about, and I've certainly mentioned many times, is when Ajahn Smedha has told the story so often that when he went to Thailand the first time after they'd set up Chidhurst Monastery in England back in about 1981, he hadn't been back to Thailand for a few years, and he went to go and see Ajahn Chah in January of that year, and Ajahn Chah asked him how it was going, and he started waxing lyrically about how amazing, how wonderful Chidhurst Monastery was. He says, "Oh, there's about 8 monks and 4 nuns there at the time, and about 3 or 4 novices and 3 or 4 or 5 lay people." He says, "Oh, it's incredible, it's amazing. I've never been in such a harmonious monastery." Just like I was saying about Abhayagiri, the people are really incredibly committed, and the monks and nuns are all diligent, and they're all extraordinarily scrupulous with the Vinaya, and they they really work hard, and they don't all get on with each other all the time, but they're really incredibly civil the way they relate with each other, and they really do their best. And I've never been with such an inspiring and marvelous harmonious group of people, and in extenso, kind of effusing like that. And then Ajahn Chah waited till he got to the end of his flow and said, "But he won't develop much wisdom being with that lot." Totally unimpressed. So, you know, "I'll send you a couple." Actually, it turned out he didn't have to. There was a couple of bombs waiting to go off that we weren't aware of. But to really be conscious of that. No, you know, this is an impermanent thing. A Bayagiri monastery is an impermanent thing. It'll fall apart one day, or it'll burn down, or everyone will leave, or maybe a year, 5 years, 10 years, 100 years, 1,000 years, who knows. But it'll fall apart, because it has to. Just like these bodies, you know, a day, a week, a month, a year, 10 years, 50 years. Sooner or later they have to go. Just noticing that investment, that quality of investment, where we're taking our ease, we're like, say, finding our comfort or our quality of resting in the five khandhas, in the form, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, moods, ideas, concepts, states of consciousness. Wanting happiness, like taking refuge in happiness, taking refuge in things going well, things being in order, things being the way I like. Rather than that, just like, in a way, getting to know the flavor of that investing of the heart. Like, got what I wanted, you know. When you're making something, or preparing some food, or you're fixing something, or you're in sitting meditation, and you know, the mind gets clear and bright, and you know, all of the thoughts fall away, and all of your favorite defilements drop off, and it's this clear, bright, open, peaceful, and no pain in the body. Yes. Right, now we're doing good. This is really good. This is the stuff. This is like, you can hear Mara rubbing his hands, like, "Oh boy, have we got a sucker here." This is a setup. You know, it's just like walking out into the freeway and this thing, "Let me have it." There's going to be a moment before we get slammed. So, and it's not that, you know, that those qualities are necessarily unwholesome in the slightest. Every single thing there, you know, why shouldn't we celebrate the mind being free of defilements and concentrated and bright and clear and lucid and brimming with insight? But as soon as that we take refuge in those qualities, then we are unconscious of the setup that we're creating, and that. What can happen, and I've known this numbers of people, it's been a major issue, that some wonderfully brilliant mystical experience set them up for 10 years of depression, because life was just like totally miserable, and just, how can I go to work on, if I was the universe on Sunday, I've got to go back to the office. I realize I am the universe, I am the ultimate reality. And then I go back to work. What a downer. So that seeing that it is wholesome, but wholesomeness is not a refuge. That's a path that we see that those are noble, wholesome, virtuous qualities. They're the path, they're not the goal. And so recognizing that sweetness, recognizing that goodness, and then restraining or refraining from allowing the heart to invest in that, which is where the contemplation of anicca comes in. It's just so simple, you know, a 2-year-old can figure out everything changes. But here, this very, you know, the most sort of refined, subatomic end of the practice, the sharpest of the sharp edges of the practice, the anicca is right there as our, as the most powerful tool. That it's all undependable, it's uncertain. Leave it alone. Don't invest in it. And when we actually practice in this way and apply that withdrawing, when we apply that restraint, when we apply that not allowing that experience or the feeling or that event to be to become dear, then rather than that being like a deadening of the heart or freezing of the heart or kind of numbing of the heart, or which, you know, it's a kind of an association we can make. When we actually follow this through, the experience is one of this subtle but extraordinarily pervasive, vast relief. Ah, I don't have to hope that this will hold together. Ah, I don't have to be anxious that Abhayagiri is never going to burn down. Ah. I don't have to worry about my gums receding or my increasing deafness or my I think it's called dysgraphia. I don't say things in the wrong order, but I type things in the wrong order. I write words with letters in the wrong order nowadays. Even the, I've started spelling T-E-H all the time now. Pretty bad when it gets down to 3-letter words. Not a lot of ways you can spell them wrong, but it's happening all the time now. Because even when I'm thinking about it, how a word is spelt, my hand will put the letters in the wrong order. Oh, you see, you've got a name for it, dysgraphia. There it goes. That ease of heart, just leaving it alone. This is the great peace, the peace beyond the limits of samsara, the peace of the heart, not burning with the 5 khandhas of form, feeling, perception, so on. It's the ease that is possible for us. This is the potential that we have in this human life to experience this. Whether we're a layperson or a monastic, whether we're new or old in the training, whether we're physically younger or older, it's totally immaterial. The mind is the mind, the body is the body. The conventions are what they are. There's no blockage, there's no hindrance in any particular set of conventions. Old body, young body, health body, healthy body, sick body, comfortable body, uncomfortable body, white clothes, brown clothes, multicolored clothes, hair, no hair, female, male. How could any of it really make a difference? Ultimately, can't. So having the resolution to be using the format of this life, looking out through this particular configuration of conditions of body and mind, to recognize the Dhamma of things. It's the same for all of us. You know, how could it not be? And that we have this wonderful potential. Anyone?